Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Karen Carbon Partners, a food business consultancy that helps clients explore the interconnections among agriculture, food, policy, and people. For more information, visit kknp.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting live from Brooklyn on Heritage Radio Network. Joining me in the studio today as co-host is our show intern, Austin Bernarski.
Happy to be here as always.
We're happy to have you. On today's episode, we will be talking about millennials. Love them or hate them, one thing is clear. They're here to stay. Millennials, or those of us born between 1980 through 2000, are now the largest generation on Earth. Dun, 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 dun. And we have money to spend. It is projected that by 2017, millennials will have more spending power than any other generation. So why are we talking about millennials on a food policy show? Because millennials, it turns out, are food obsessed. We buy, grow, make, discuss, photograph, post, evaluate, and eat it in a way that arguably no generation has before. In fact, households under 30 spend 75% more than the average household on food and 84% more on food away from home. With us here in the studio to unpack the origin and degree of this obsession, as well as what it spells for the future of the food system in America, is Eve Turow-Paul. Eve is a freelance food, travel, and culture writer who recently authored the book A Taste of Generation Yum. Later on the show, we'll also be speaking with Hallie Meyer, a fellow millennial and co-founder of the food startup Umi. Eve, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. An awesome intro. Oh,
thank you. Pulled a lot of the stats from your book, wouldn't you
know? Appreciate that. Plug away.
All right. Well, I want to start by unpacking the term millennial. So Who is Generation Yum that you referred to in your book, and what are some of the dominant traits of millennialism, if you will?
Yeah, for sure. So, first and foremost, at the beginning of my book, I make it very clear that I'm talking about a subset of the millennial generation. So there's a major, major part of this generation that can't afford their next meal, that doesn't know where their next meal is coming from. Mm-hmm. So I could have written, or could write, potentially someday, a book on that population. But this is really the population I'm talking about, is middle to upper income millennials who are spending the vast majority of the money in this economy around food. And the biggest distinction that you see between millennials and Gen Xers, which is the generation before us, is the fact that we were raised really with one foot out in and one foot out of the technological boom. So I remember going to library classes where I learned about the Dewey Decimal System.
Yes. I know.
And then went to like my typing class where I played Oregon Trail and learned.
I love that game.
Right. You know, but texting came about when I was in high school, and I was the first generation and first year to meet my college peers on Facebook before in person. Mm-hmm. So we've really grown up with a lot of this technology, and the effect of that is starting to show within our behavior.
Okay. And so how, by the way, just for all of you guys listening, Austin, who is and on the earlier side, I would say, of the generational scale.
I'm 21, I think.
I feel like we might have lost you at the Oregon Trail reference.
No. I always died of dysentery.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, glad to know you're you're still with us.
That's fantastic. Tamagotchis?
Totally went over my head.
No, you didn't have Tamagotchis.
Okay. So how does this relate to food? You know, I mean, so the technological divide and food.
Wait, so as you pointed out in your intro, we are the first generation ever to be spending our discretionary income on food. Like, if millennials really think about their parents or baby boomers, what did they spend their discretionary income on? They spent it on drugs and they spent it on music.
Mm-hmm.
And food was something kind of for, like, the hoity-toity. It was like going to opera or playing golf. Young people were not concerned about what they were having for dinner. They were concerned about what show they were going to and how they were going to get high on the way there.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
A la Anthony Bourdain.
A la Anthony Bourdain. A la all of our parents.
Yeah.
And today, you know, it's not necessarily the rock show that is the focus of the evening. It's where you're going to dinner. It's the chef. It's the menu. It's where that menu was created and where the local ingredients were coming from. And that is now the topic of concern, and it is also the new form of social currency among our generation. We're judging each other based on food choices. Mm. We're proclaiming our values based on food choices, and when we post those images of whatever we ate online.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess this sort of like visual, the way that we value food very visually and aesthetically, I think, has been part and parcel with social media.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sort of wondering how has, like, I think in one part of your book, or in the end of the book, you say that millennials will make or break the food movement and
right.
sort of will spell the way forward in terms of food policy.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, like, a lot of people see social media as being more superficial and maybe not necessarily.
Yeah.
Well, like hard social movement. And I'm wondering where the divide between that is.
Well, so, I mean, it's a really good point. The social media and clicks, right, are the new form of consumption.
Right.
Yeah.
So it partially matters what we're actually eating it and doing and buying, but clicks and shares at this point in time are just as valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, the way that we're using it is more of a performance. It's more of building our own personal brand
mm-hmm.
by saying, I know about organic, I can afford to eat at Blue Hill,
mm-hmm.
I can, I'm like super talented and worldly, and my daughter is eating sushi. You know, whatever
yeah.
it is that you're
yeah.
saying. But there is the opportunity for this generation to start saying, I care about fair labor rights for
right.
farm workers. I care about the farm bill. I care that my local farmer is getting the subsidies that he or she needs in order to provide
mm-hmm.
For my neighborhood. But that hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that we are starting to see like some of these kind of, you know, people's more political points of view coming out on social media platforms.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's a lot of value in that. I mean, some might say you're preaching to the choir because, you
yeah.
know, it's like your friends, right? You're
yeah.
not really necessarily
well,
connecting with people who disagree with you. But.
I think that people sometimes underestimate the power that is involved with the internet and the people that follow you. I mean, if you've ever started a blog at any point in time, you pretty quickly realize that there are like some random people that end up finding you.
Really?
<reading.
laughs> Oh, yeah.
yeah. I feel like I'm the only person who is into food that didn't start a food blog.
Well, I blogged when I used to travel a lot on my own, and I would blog as I went, mostly for my family, and then suddenly
yeah.
it would be like, there's like a community in Vietnam that's following me. And
you're like, hey, guys.
And I'm like, I don't know you, but this is great. But so I think that maybe young people are, you know, they're not really understanding the power that they do have simply by voicing their opinion online. You might feel like you're preaching to the choir, but in reality, just putting that information out there, you don't know who's going to share that with their own network then.
Yeah, that's
going
true.
Forward.
That's a great point. So what would you say are some, I mean, I think that it seemed like psychology was like a big,
yeah.
you know, you really wanted to kind of get into the why.
Yes, exactly.
And so can you tell us a little bit about your findings, like what really drives people towards food,
mm-hmm.
and then maybe and how that plays with just kind of like general psychological observations about our generation?
Yeah, yeah. So I jumped into this topic from a very superficial level, which is I wanted to understand my own behavior.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
And I wanted to understand the behavior of my peers and my friends who were taking pictures of their food or, you know, paying $100 for an underground dinner that, like, really wasn't so great, but they felt really satisfied after because they'd met cool people and had a neat experience. And, you know, it ended up becoming far more interesting because I ended up using food as the lens really to look at this generation from a deeper level. And it became very clear. I mean, I did 4 years of interviews and digging into a lot of different science journals and sociology and psychology, a lot of time in the NYU library.
Like the LexisNexis. Yeah.
JSTOR.
JSTOR.
Yeah. Wow. Science Direct.
I do not miss that.
No, it makes me sad. I'm like, it makes me sad for school. I miss it.
Okay. I mean, yeah, I still do it every day. So this is pretty much ongoing of my life. But I really, you know, discovered that food is serving as the anti-technology. And we are the first generation to grow up really infused in the technological space. And obviously, this is also why you see these trends also resonating in Gen X and boomers, because they're also spending a good amount of time on their phones and in front of screens and iPads and whatnot. But the way that millennials are using food is to serve needs that are unmet by technology. And those key needs are community, sensory stimulation, identity formation, and control. And one of the key findings really was that we are an increasingly depressed and anxious generation, which is, I mean, it's an uncomfortable thing to face, but, you know, one of the through lines of millennials really around the world is we feel a growing lack of autonomy over our own lives. And that's partially because we don't trust political institutions. It's partially because of climate change. It's partially because of recessions.
Some of the things that we've lived through, like you wrote about in your book, kind of the major events that have caused a distrust maybe in the political system.
Yeah. And,
no, I think it's that definitely resonated.
So, you know, and there's just very, there's distinct parts of the psychology of this generation that are satisfied and soothed by a variety of different interactions that all revolve around food.
One thing, you know, I have to say, this might be like the most millennial thing, but I was reading your book and I like halfway through put it down and I think I like turned to my husband and I was like, you know, food used to be the thing that differentiated me from people. Like I, you know, have culinary training and community gardened and have worked in food policy for a while, but now everyone's doing it. Like it was like an existential crisis of like, I'm not special.
But you are.
You're here right now. That's what matters.
And my husband's response is like, yeah, you're a millennial.
There's something so interesting though in what you're saying, which comes up a lot in your book too, which is that our attachment to this thing that we call the food movement really has a lot to do with our need for actually a sense of identification with a movement.
Right.
And I guess one question I have for you is how can you channel that power that you get, the power that we have by posting an article? How can you actually channel the like and the crazy
retweet
sense of movement around it to actually moving the needle on an issue in the world that affects maybe mostly the people who aren't talking about it? And you know, this is obviously something that like this is something I that really kind of plagues me as a millennial too, who is working in the world of food. I mean, how can you actually get better food to more people?
Right. So I think you're asking like a key question that a lot of people aren't realizing, which is that millennials are currently being vocal about food issues when it relates to something that is pretty direct to them. Right. So they care about antibiotics. They care about GMOs. They care about pesticides because
they're putting it in their body.
They're putting it in their body. Exactly. And something that's a bit less tangible than that, such as farm subsidies or pesticide runoff.
Or food access
Or fair labor rights. That's not really getting a whole lot of attention. Mm-hmm. But the recommendation that I make and what I think is most realistic as a starting point is food waste. Because I do think we need to understand, like, yes, we are living in this land of branding, of performance, of a need to feel like you have a little bit more control. And food waste is a way that people can participate every single day, right? You can become aware of what you're throwing out, what you're not throwing out, what you're composting, what you're donating. You can also create a really awesome recipe for like cauliflower stems or carrot tops and post that online and feel super altruistic and feel super sustainable. And I'm hoping that with food waste, because it incorporates so many different topics, it addresses in some ways food access. It addresses in some ways sustainability, climate change, that that will at least start educating consumers on the influence that they can have. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then perhaps we can build on that.
So in your mind, almost, you know, milking the self,
yeah,
kind of the need for self-branding, yeah, is really the answer. I mean, and you also talk about the food movement itself not actually having one issue that, right, we have yet to rally around.
Exactly.
And I personally thought it was pretty unfortunate when, like, GMOs became the thing that we started to rally,
yes,
around,
I
because
agree,
it seemed like this sort of easy thing that the food movement decided to put as its billboard issue, and really didn't get at a lot of the important issues, which are the human systems behind,
right, well,
the
and
food system.
Right. I mean, GMOs, to me, it's a key example for marketers, actually, at what,
yes,
what not to do.
Exactly.
And I think that Monsanto's done a massive disservice to people by shrouding GMOs in secrecy. And, I mean, this does, it relates back to all my findings, which is that if we don't understand, if we, meaning millennials, do not understand something, if you're not being forthright with us, we don't want it. And
right,
we're not going to trust you that it's good for us.
Yeah, transparency and trust, I think, are huge needs of,
right,
this.
Mm-hmm. And generation. Most people, if you talk to them and say, you know, what is a GMO? And they're anti-GMO. They
have
don't
no
know.
Idea. Yeah. No idea.
They also don't know all the good that GMOs,
exactly,
have done.
Right.
In terms of food,
right,
equality, yeah.
Right. And
this
so
program is brought to you by Monsanto. And Hallie Meyer. No, but it is true. It is. It's an issue that I think was kind of co-opted, and for whatever reason, it gained a lot of popularity very quickly. And it was the
it's
one
easy.
That kind of it's easy. Yeah. It's easy, and it's and I think from an environmental standpoint, right, there is a lot to be said there, and it can do a lot of good for this movement, but not for the reasons why it gained popularity. That's not why it became popular.
I think it's a really amazing sign for those in the food movement of, like, the power,
yes,
that can be harnessed.
Mm-hmm.
Around a food issue.
Right.
And it came about because I don't think there were people in the food movement that were paying enough attention, that were really driving the conversation. But we've seen what can happen when cage-free becomes a topic.
Oh, my God.
When antibiotics becomes a topic.
Mm-hmm.
When non-GMO becomes a topic.
Well, also, when you engage, I think, the private sector, right? You really...
Right.
I think that there is a lot to be said here for, as you write about, like, the purchasing power of this generation,
yeah,
and being able to vote with your dollars. And since this generation is very clear on, you know, we want transparency, and we want it basically to do good in,
yeah,
a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I think that we can harness that to really move the private sector in the direction that we want.
Yeah, and I do want to, like, emphasize here that big food and even the government is going to respond to what this generation is demanding. And Tally, to your point, like, I have a fear,
yeah,
which is that when foodies, quote unquote, mm-hmm, achieve what they want to achieve in terms of their own good eating, that they're going to kind of...
It's going to be only them.
Give up on the... Right. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not really going to care about the rest of the food movement. And I think that we're kind of at a really pivotal moment where it's like, either we can get these people really engaged and drive this forward so that we create a momentum that big food can't ignore, because they're going to realize that they can't make enough money,
mm-hmm,
unless they respond to it. But there is a responsibility of people in this food sector to make sure that that happens.
Right. And I want to talk a little bit about that, though, because how do you make that transition? I do have a question kind of around the term foodie and,
yeah,
what that means, and I want to talk about that in a minute. But, like, isn't it a good thing, right? Doesn't it just start with people just becoming interested, and who cares how they become interested in food,
mm-hmm,
be it through, like, the Cronut effect,
yeah,
you know, or,
yeah, yeah,
this cool restaurant? Like, it doesn't matter, because ultimately, inevitably,
mm-hmm,
you're going to start to think, like, how did this come to be on my plate, and,
yeah,
where did the ingredients come from? And then, I mean, that leads to questions about food systems,
mm-hmm,
right? So isn't it going to be an inevitable trend towards more people caring?
I would love to hear your thoughts. I feel like I'm a little bit more skeptical, and I think that what you've gotten at, which is the power of social media and the power of one's sense of attachment to a movement via the like, is actually, like, it's hugely powerful, but, like, it toes the line between powerful and super distracting. But
yeah,
I'm eager to hear.
No, I mean,
your,
I think,
maybe less cynical thoughts.
I am a very a pessimistic person, actually. So,
but I'm an optimist, but
I do have faith in this because you know, I think the power of chefs mm-hmm. is something that's really amazing, something new that's developed. But if you okay, for example, Roy Choi. Right. He's opened up local on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. Number one, like, people think that they're, like, Roy Choi's friend, right? Because, like, Roy Choi is, like, a super cool dude, and you can read his memoir, like, you can get to know him, go to his restaurants, and suddenly he's like, hey, guys, guess what? Like, I care about feeding people mm-hmm. food that they can afford that's not going to give them heart disease. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think it's opening up people's minds. And you can say the same thing about Dan Barber, mm-hmm. that he has so many different fans, and then he did the Wasted pop-up, and people were like, oh, right.
Oh, food waste.
Problem.
Right.
That's a thing.
Yeah, right.
And I think another one of the indicators that you use that I think is really effective is the sort of proliferation of food studies programs.
Yeah.
And I think, from personal experience, like, I got interested in food because Saturday and Sunday mornings, I wasn't watching cartoons. I was watching the Food Network, which right. I'm a little bit embarrassed to admit, but that's what allowed me to pursue...
It's you along with everyone else.
Right, exactly. That's yeah. what allowed me as a student to pursue food studies right. in this sort of like critically engaged,
right.
Sort of skeptical perspective that, you know, makes me want to
right.
do mm-hmm. work in food policy. For
and
the
if,
rest of
if I really, if you start to like get down to the nitty gritty, like what separates younger millennials versus older millennials, it is that younger millennials are even more educated at a younger age about food because of the proliferation of food studies programs, of farms on campuses, of bringing food access into more of the public debate.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is amazing. And then yeah. if you really think about like going forward and talk about how millennials are becoming parents, there is a trend, which is that millennials say that they'll buy organic and say that they'll shop sustainably more than they actually do, mm-hmm. right? Because if we're all being honest with ourselves, you go to the supermarket and you see two heads of broccoli. One is generic and it's $2 and the organic is $5. Yeah. You're getting the $2 broccoli, yeah. right? I mean, because we're also like very thrifty. But
well, we're also kind of broke, but underemployed, I would
yes,
say.
Yeah. And... But the real question comes in, like, well, so, but once people have kids, which head of broccoli are they going to get?
Yeah.
And they're far more likely to actually invest in the organic broccoli, which also means, A, hopefully, organic sales are going to continue to go up. And I think you're seeing Jessica Alba tapping into this with the Honest yeah. Company. Oh, my God, is she making a killing? But it's for this reason. And
yeah.
and then you're also going to have kids that grew up eating organic. Mm-hmm. Right? Whose parents were emphasizing that.
Right, and that was a priority in their household. Okay, we're going to take a quick commercial break and hear a word from our sponsors, and we'll be back in a minute with the second half of our show.
Karen Carbon Partners is a food business consultancy that helps clients explore the interconnections among agriculture, food, policy, and people. They help coordinate executives, school and government officials, distributors, and farmers think clearly about how food is produced, processed, and distributed, encouraging them to overcome challenges and pursue innovation. Their Good Food is Good Business division supports the healthy development, execution, and operations of food businesses and initiatives in the public and private sectors through strategic sourcing, feasibility analysis, market research, business planning, project management, and evaluation. Their Good People are Good Business division builds leadership and organizational effectiveness through talent and performance management, organizational assessment, executive coaching, recruiting, and employee engagement services. For more than 20 years, Karen Carbon Partners has been integral to the development and execution of food businesses, policies, and partnerships in the U.S. and the U.K. Visit them on the web at kknp.com.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today we're speaking with author Eve Turopal about the millennial generation's food obsession. I am now going to turn to you, Hallie Meyer, and put you in the hot seat. As I mentioned in the intro, Hallie is a fellow millennial, a recent Yale grad, and the co-founder of Umi, a home cooking marketplace.
That is right.
What's a home cooking marketplace?
Yeah, so a marketplace, the marketplace piece of the word, means that there's a supply and a demand. We hope there's a demand, at least. So we're basically a platform where really talented culinary entrepreneurs, whether you have been cooking your whole life and you're, you know, a self-considered home cook or an aspiring chef, culinary school grad, anyone trying to make a name for themselves, or maybe you're a stay-at-home mom or a stay-at-home dad who makes a killer coq au vin that needs to get out there. We're selling that tonight, actually, from Mark's from Mark's Paleo Kitchen. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
So we connect these people with customers, families, really, who for whom dinner hour is something that they want to get right, but that's broken at this point. They can either order takeout or spend time cooking, which they don't have. And we deliver it to their door.
Yeah. Wonderful. How did you come up with this concept?
So I actually didn't come up with the concept itself. My co-founder did. His name is Khalil. His mom is the original Umi, and she basically would do this. So she would actually vacuum seal her home cooking, her Lebanese home cooking.
Wow.
And send it to him when he was in some pretty sketchy situations in Afghanistan. So we met in New Haven, where I also met Austin. Khalil was a Yale law student. I was a Yale undergrad. And we kind of totally hit it off, did a series of trials, operated for 7 weeks there. We got very lucky with the amazing culinary community that's hiding in New Haven's home kitchens, and learned a ton about the model. And from there, we decided let's actually do this thing and launch it in Brooklyn.
So one of the things Eve mentions in your book is this concept of authenticity. So, you know, this idea that's super highly valued and sought after, and similarly naturalness. So I'm wondering, like, how Umi's business is centered on some of these themes.
Yeah. So I think interestingly, I have.
Do you want to talk about the word authenticity?
Yeah. So I personally don't love that word because it seems to have lost a little bit of its meaning.
Authenticity.
Thanks so much. Can you just remind me what's the word we're talking about again? Yeah. But the word itself, I think, stripped of all context, actually just means real, right? Okay. Yeah. So, but I think also the word real has been contextualized.
This is a rabbit hole. Yeah.
So when I think of an authentic home cooked meal, great. It has two qualifiers now. But what we're really hoping to sell with Umi is just a home cooked meal by your talented neighbor, no matter what type of home cooking they do, whether they choose to source their food entirely locally from their local farmers market, or maybe what's really authentic is their grandma's lasagna recipe that uses canned San Marzanos and excellent ricotta that they don't happen to hand make.
Right.
But the idea that there is intention and love poured into a meal, I think that suffices as a definition of authentic for me.
All right.
And is Umi engaging, specifically with millennials? Like, is that a target? I know nothing about the startup business, so pardon me if I'm not using the right lingo, but is that your, like, intended market? And are these the heartstrings you're pulling to specifically? Or you mentioned families are a huge part of this. And I guess millennials now are just the first wave of people having children are now, or people who are having children now are millennials.
Yeah, I think interestingly, Khalil and I are both millennials, but our target audience and the people for whom we're hoping to solve problems on the demand side our families. These are parents who are way older than us, who actually aren't on Instagram as much, and who actually aren't really, they're not in this same conversation around food. They're in a conversation around, I want to raise a family and I want to serve my kids good food, and Blue Apron takes too long, and I feel guilty putting takeout on the dinner table.
So I was going to say, there's such an opening in this marketplace because for the first time, really, you have a huge population of families where both spouses are working.
Right.
And the work-life balance, there is no balance, like, let's be real. And at the same time, people are also starting to understand that they don't want to be eating processed foods. They don't necessarily even trust the chicken in the Thai food, the takeout, right?
There's a drive towards home cooking. We know that it's better.
And there's something about understanding the face and story behind that meal, and also knowing that you're able to keep food spend in your community, that I think is driving a lot of the interest in this, that you're saying, where am I spending my dinner dollars? People are thinking about that. And like you talk a lot about, the millennial generation is super powerful, and they are kind of influencing what
they're completely influencing.
Young parents and even, older people are thinking about.
So I think you just used the word community, and I think if I'm not misunderstood, that's in your title, right?
Yeah.
Hallie Meyer is the head of community at Umi Kitchen. and I think that can also be sort of a messy term, right? Because we have these
we definitely haven't defined it yet.
Great. We have these global businesses like Uber or
Airbnb,
these businesses that are like
bringing people together,
right? Supposedly, in this category of the sharing economy, but it seems, and maybe I'm just hopeful, but Umi is really linking people together in a way that maybe these businesses only claim to be doing.
I certainly hope so. I think one thing that we're super conscious of all the time is that we're a tech platform at the end of the day, right? And so this is opening an app and ordering dinner, understanding the story and seeing the person's face and, meeting your neighbor, but it is a digital experience. So two challenges. How can we actually capture that real experience of, seeing someone who just made a meal for you give it to you and see the satisfaction in their face that nourishing others gives them? How can we replicate that digitally? But also, how can we make sure that that's something we really actually foster offline as well? So,
well, can you replicate that digitally is a question.
Yeah.
And I think because Eve proposes that food is the anti-technology.
Right.
You're on the
record. Well, I mean, people do use technology to facilitate connection in person, right? And so there's really interesting statistics around anxiety, depression, internet use, things like that. People who use these social networks in order to avoid in-person communication
or to compare themselves,
right?
Against.
Exactly, are the ones that have the highest rates of loneliness and depression. But people who use the internet to facilitate in-person meetings, like people who use Meetup.com or who are doing something like this, where you're actually meeting other people, those are the people who are deriving the greatest benefits from social media platforms.
Right. And I can think of, very few other things that are as intimate as
a home-cooked meal.
A home-cooked meal is feeding somebody, right? That's one of the reasons. That's how I express love in my household. So I think that
well, and in so many ways, we're just, moving backwards in a certain sense.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Of, this is what everyone did, right? You fed your neighbors.
Yep. Mm-hmm. There's really no reinvention of the wheel here.
Right.
I mean, well, but there has, this is happening.
But there has been a total breakdown of social capital. Let's go back. Come on, my recent undergrads. Social capital, Huntington, ringing any bells.
Bowling alone.
Yeah. I mean, I think that,
English major, I was busy with Shakespeare. So.
Oh, God. Sorry. Who? No, I'm just kidding. It's terrible.
Okay.
but it is bringing people together, and that's something that you talk about also, kind of food is a sense of community. And what I think is interesting is you see that sort of manifest in a lot of different ways, be it through the Bite Club experience where you come together with strangers, or meetup, .com or cooking for your neighbor who you don't maybe necessarily know.
Mm-hmm. And gluten-free singles, I've seen, is now a dating site.
No.
Is it really?
Oh, my God.
I can't tell if it's a joke. Or not, but it exists as a URL.
Yeah.
That's great.
I can't say I've ever signed up because I am
vehemently pro-gluten.
The only reason that that does make sense is because people are not just using what they are eating, but also what they're not eating as a sign of their value system. So vegans feel like they have a certain value system that they're putting out there. Mm-hmm. And perhaps people who are gluten-free feel like they have a similar value system associated with that. So you want to meet some... It's like a religion.
And I was just at Superiority Burger for lunch.
Let's take apart the name of that institution.
I think it captures a lot of the anxieties that, you know, someone who wants to brag about their vegetarianism has.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a good burger, though.
It's amazing.
Oh, my gosh. You guys have to try the Philly cheesesteak. It might be
I'm literally going tomorrow night, so.
I'll text you.
Millennials in action.
Here we go.
Actually just a social experiment that we're putting on today.
To plug Superiority Burger.
And Monsanto.
Well, we're going to have to wrap up soon, but Hallie, where can we find... Where can we find a home-cooked meal these days?
Yeah, so we'll be launching our app in about 3 weeks from now, and you'll be able to download it. But for now, just go to www.umi.kitchen. We got pretty lucky with that URL.
Yeah.
And we're running a series of small trials where we're delivering meals twice a week.
To Greenpoint?
Not to Greenpoint yet.
Gowanus.
We'll be in Gowanus, Borum Hill, Carroll Gardens, Cobble Hill, Clinton Hill, Park Slope, and kind of the Prospect Heights-y area.
Mm. Oh, Kim Kessler will need to know.
Yeah. Yes.
Our awesome
co-host and producer and
beloved inventor of eating matters.
The beloved inventor.
I can't wait for some of our awesome culinary entrepreneurs to feed her.
And Eve, where can we find Generation Yum?
So you can get Generation Yum. It's in print at McNally Jackson in Soho. It's also available basically at any e-retailer for books. You can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Google, all of those great places.
All of the
above. Totally worth the read.
Yep.
Oh, thanks,
yep,
Hallie.
Wonderful. It was great. Okay, guys, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. To our guests, Eve Turopal and Hallie Meyer. Our show is produced by my brilliant co-host, Kim Kessler, and myself, and our wonderful intern and co-host today is the one and only Austin Brynjarski. Yay, Austin!
I'm entitled to applause.
You are
as a
validation. Great job, Austin.
Austin, let's go get ice cream.
Let's go.
But before I'm gonna wrap this up here. No. Show music is by Tim Archer. Thank you to our sponsors and our show engineer, David Tedis Shore. The show is available on Heritage Radio Network or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. You can also find us on Twitter at Eat Matters HRN. Please find us on Twitter. I'm Jenna Liut, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like,
Why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.